From the Sky News Centre at 6. Labour says it's been left disappointed by the Prime Minister's refusal to compromise in talks aimed at breaking the Brexit deadlock. Shadow Secretary for Leaving the EU, Sir Keir Starmer, has been speaking after a third day of discussions.
So far, the government isn't proposing any changes to the deal. In particular, it's not countenancing any change to the actual wording of the political declaration. Now, obviously, that's disappointing. Compromise requires change.
Meanwhile, Theresa May's found herself at odds with the European Council over how long Brexit should be delayed for. She wants until the end of June at the latest, but Donald Tusk is suggesting an extension of around a year. Relatives of 21 people killed in two pub bombings in Birmingham in 1974 are demanding new criminal investigations. An inquest jury has found a botched call by the IRA to warn people about the devices had caused or contributed to the deaths because the phone was faulty. Julie Hambleton lost her sister.
The inquest has brought to light new evidence. West Midlands Police have always told us when they get new evidence, they will act on it. Well, here you go. You have the new evidence. And I'm sure there is more to be had and more to be found.
A 25-year-old man has admitted murdering a young woman at a flat in Leeds. Poppy Davy Waterhouse, who was 24, died after being stabbed last December. Joe Atkinson's been remanded in custody ahead of sentencing next week. Nine Brunei-owned luxury hotels that faced a backlash over the country's new anti-gay laws have deleted their social media accounts. George Clooney is among the celebrities calling for a boycott of those owned by the country. It seems WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange won't be leaving the Ecuadorian embassy, where he's been since 2012, just yet. The embassy is playing down reports suggesting he could be kicked out soon. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Download the BCFM radio app today. Wherever you are, you can take Bristol's most diverse community radio station with you and never miss a thing.
BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Green Party councillor for Clifton Down, Clive Stevens. Retired international relations lecturer and author, Ron Mandel, is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, an attempt to exonerate the police who fitted up a man with learning disabilities, just as if the BBC had given a whole programme just to spread the views of the detectives who fitted up the Guildford 4 and Birmingham 6. What a disgusting piece of television this week on the Jill Dando anniversary. Tonight we make a real attempt to do Jill justice by looking at the reasons she may have been killed, the motive and those who had the means and opportunity, the alleged group of hired killers in Hungary who confessed the crime to a Buckinghamshire engineer and, he says, offered to kill three police he was in a long legal dispute with for $10,000 apiece. Boasting the Dando murder as proof they could do the job. And he told the UK police about it at the time in 1999 and they did nothing. Plus, the 1MDB scandal in Malaysia starts to go to the courts. This is Goldman Sachs helping the Prime Minister there in a $4.5 billion alleged fraud. Signs of the rise of fascism in Eastern Europe and particularly and in other parts of Europe too, and Brussels apparently is turning a blind eye. Plus, a Saudi nuclear reactor nears completion. Not hearing a lot about that on the BBC. Yeah. Plus carried over from last week. Christian Zionist hate pastors in the United States. What are they saying to encourage the killing of Muslims? And words of encouragement for Israeli politicians. From the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, the secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about Israeli states, biblical history and the rights? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs around 16, light cloud and a moderate breeze, but should be mostly rain-free. Next week, temperatures up to 14 Celsius, cloud cover and rain, mainly cloudy, with a few showers, though. Next weekend, the 13th and 14th of April, highs of 11 Celsius with patchy rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. On the weekend, the schools break up for the Easter holiday, and Martin Summers isn't with us because he's on a bit of a booze-up with his work colleagues tonight. So anyway, joining me to review this week's news is Green Party councillor for Clifton Down, Clive Stevens, and retired international relations lecturer and author, Ron Mandel. But I think we'll start with you tonight, Ron. You've just come back from Vietnam. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like out there these days? Is it still raging communists, and is it still the bugbear of the United States and the Pentagon?
Well, there's no sign of communism as such. The billboards basically were very commercial-oriented, and this is verified by the fact that 20% of the Vietnamese economy is generated by foreign direct investment. In Ho Chi Minh City, in the city center, you could not walk a street without seeing a Starbucks, Adidas, and other major U.S. corporations. The most interesting thing I found about Vietnam was that the people were not at all anti-American. I spoke to a number of people, even people who remembered the Vietnam War. They had no animosity against American people. They made a distinction between the American people and the U.S. government. And their feeling was that that was years ago. Now they have a future to look forward to. And the United States and Vietnam now have very friendly relations, and particularly because both the United States and Vietnam are probably suspicious of China. China seems to be a common threat to both those countries.
I mean, even though they say they're communist, they're not. They're rather like the Chinese, aren't they? They're really beating the Americans at capitalism.
It's exactly right. It's a communist political system, which they don't tolerate dissent. The elections basically are skewed to elect communist officials. And you're quite right. You probably can describe the Chinese and Vietnamese economies as state capitalists. Basically it's a capitalist economic system, but orchestrated or managed by the state.
Would you recommend it as a place to visit?
Yes, I would.
Okay, let's talk about some of the national stories this week. Anyway, and start with, I think we'll talk about 5G, because I notice there's been quite a lot of discussion about this new mobile technology, which is being pioneered in big inverted commas here in Bristol. Health standards were written apparently 30 years ago for this system. It is effectively a new basically it'll sell you a new phone, an upgraded so-called phone, which works, and anywhere you'll see different people saying different things, but anywhere between 50 and 100 times faster than 4G. And I can tell you, on my phone I can upload a 4G on my phone, I can upload an hour long film on 4G onto YouTube. It will take about 15 minutes. I don't know quite how much faster, but they seem to want you to be able to do it in 1 minute. Mm-hmm. Or apparently you can download a feature film within seconds. So that's what we're getting at the consumer end, and we're being told that that's a wonderful thing to have. But what are we getting on the health end? That's the question. And the health standards were written 30 years ago. I'll put a link up to this on our show page. This is from wired.com. by a private German group called the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation, who are loyal to the telecom and energy industries. They elect their own members and they're accountable to nobody. So those are the people who've drawn up the standards for 5G. There are all sorts of stories we could talk about. I'll just ask you, Clive, what you make of this new technology, because there is, it is, you know, it seems to be that the proper checks and balances haven't been made. I was looking at some of the articles in the local papers about this, and on, for example, Bristol 24/7, really just eulogising it, saying, "Isn't it wonderful? Bristol's been chosen to this new technology with no mention of the health possible health effects."
Well, I was checking out some of the technical documentation because I did physics and I've been in radio technology for quite a while. And I must say I'm a little bit concerned. It operates at 10 times the frequency of the 4G, and it has a couple of characteristics. When you add them together, it means it should be properly tested. At the frequencies it operates at, the if impact on the human skull is it's a very shallow, so it doesn't go in and hurt the brain, but it could have impact on your skin. And because it's short range, it has to be operated at a much higher power. And I see already that the power regulations have been relaxed somewhat. So whether or not it's needed, I don't know, but I do feel that it needs a bit more studying into its safety. It's not a cancer-causing thing, cause it's not ionisation, but it's up at the level of, it's beyond microwaves, so it's got a local heating effect, and if that heating effect is very shallow, that could be quite harmful. I wouldn't use it as a phone. It might be great as a data device, but don't hold it to your head.
Around 250 scientists from around the world signed a petition to the UN and World Health Organization outlining their concerns about this new technology. And they actually say that your sweat glands can actually act as antennae. So I don't know if you think that's potentially true. It sounds bizarre, doesn't it, that water in your body can be picked up and actually absorb these microwaves. Of course, we know if you put something in a microwave oven, well, if it's living, it's not going to last long.
Oh, back to me. Okay. I agree. I mean, we're dealing with much different frequencies than a normal mobile phone, and it's even above the a microwave. And this has heating effects. It will impact the water in human bodies. Got salt in, so it's a conducting substance, and it will act as almost bits of metal. And the water will heat as well. So, join that group of scientists if I was scientific enough, but I'd sign that as well.
Now, Ron, I wonder what you make of this. I don't want to be too negative about this. Maybe it's going to be wonderful and it's going to really help us all out. One thing which is very different to the current 4G and the normal mobile is that is going to be really loads more actual antennae, because it needs to be quite close to the receivers. They're going to be everywhere. They're going to be putting them in lampposts, the top of lampposts, all the way down the street.
Yeah, I share Clive's concerns. I don't want to be unduly alarmist, but there have been a number of studies conducted which actually highlight the potential health risk by using this technology. There's a strong correlation, for example, between the technology which was used on rats, and they uncovered a higher incidence of heart tumors and brain tumors. This was conducted by the National Toxicology Program in the United States. I think the Observer in July reported that I think there were 236 scientists from 35 countries, based on some of the evidence that they've accumulated, calling for a moratorium on going forward with 5G. As a former health and safety representative at the University of Northampton, I would err on the cautious side. I think at the very least we have to have a moratorium on going forward with this technology until we have an independent study bring together the expertise of scientists and health personnel to look at the possible risk.
Well, that's exactly what 1,000 or so people have done in Glastonbury. They're petitioning the Glastonbury Town Council to say no 5G until you've satisfied us and yourselves, and you had a proper discussion and a proper debate. So they've put that to the Glastonbury Town Council, who are debating it now. I wonder, Clive, do you think this is being taken seriously, any of the health risks of this at the Bristol City Council?
No, I don't think it is. The local plan actually is out for consultation at the moment, which talks about high-speed telecommunications. And the little bit on mobile comms is we can go ahead as long as it's proved safe, national approvals, then we can't do anything locally.
So is that as well as the boxes have been ticked? I mean, what these scientists are saying, I mean, this appeal, this is from Deutsche Welle, the German site. What they're saying is the appeal outlined effects include increased cancer risk, cellular stress, increase in harmful free radicals, whatever they are. Well, they sound quite good, actually, don't they? But apparently they're not. Genetic damage, structural and functional changes of the reproductive system, learning and memory defects, neurological disorders, negative impacts on general well-being in humans.
Well, I'm not sure about all that, especially the reproductive. It depends where you keep your mobile phone, I guess. Having looked at the science behind it and what the cause, I can see some reasons why you need to be a bit more careful with the precautionary principle. Mm. Now, Bristol City Council, as a planning authority, are possibly having to duck the issue because we've had complaints about 2G, 3G, 4G. So now national planning law says local authorities, you can't reject on safety. If the nation says it's safe, then local authorities, you just have to accept that. But I have very little faith in the national authorities at the moment. They seem to be financed by all sorts of big business.
Well, also, it seems to me that all the plans for this have been drawn up by the industry themselves. This is a little bit like what the first link on the Wired website was saying about the standards being used for 5G being drawn up by this private German group, the International Commission for Non-Ionising Radiation, who aren't actually they're industry members and accountable to nobody. But Ron, damage apparently is not limited to humans. This is another aspect of these technologies. There's growing effect of harmful effects in plant and animal life. Now, there's been a lot of reports of potentially the powerful mobile phone masts affecting insects, with reports of bees being able to sort of detect these things, and they just keep well away from them, or they can't find the hive. So I don't know, I mean, whether you take that sort of thing seriously. It's not just about us, is it? It's about the whole natural environment.
Right, I mean, and we're integrated within that environment. Anything that would have a potentially negative impact on the environment will come back to haunt us. Can I just refer back to Clive's, I think, very insightful observation? No one can talk about this technology as being safe. Even the National Health Service basically said they were not able to identify any short-term health risk, but they were uncertain about the long-term impact. Now, if I heard that, my hair would stand up, because it's not the short-term impact, because most technologies don't have a short-term impact. It's the longer-term impact, which is basically very incremental, which I think needs to be studied and examined. We need impartial scientific investigation before we go forward with this technology.
So would either of you like to guess what the government is auctioning these 5G licenses off for? A piece for each of the mobile phone companies?
I'll go at $5 billion. Each.
Actually, it's only that's very OTT. Actually, it's only $1.4 billion
each.
Yeah.
How many packages have they put in?
They reckon it's about 5 or 6. So okay. You're probably right, actually. In fact, maybe $6 or $7 billion pounds the government's going to get from this. So maybe that might be a motivating factor rather than our health. I think we'll leave it at that and just ask, you know, the city council and residents of the city to have a good look at this before this whole thing gets installed, and we can do much less about it once it's in there. Any prospect of actually getting the council to take this seriously, Clive? I mean, the Green Party, I would have thought, this would be their sort of thing, actually. Your sort of thing.
Well, it is, and writing to the council, which is one of the things I'm going to be doing, and thank you, Tony, for raising the issue indirectly by making me check it out. I know what the council will say, but I think if enough people write in, that creates enough weight of pressure, and we can make statements at the next council meetings and the like, and the local plan eventually has to be voted through by full council. But the main area is actually to get the national government to sort that out. And, of course, they're only thinking about one thing, which is party unity. And that's going to be a struggle. So in the meantime, we will suffer. We have bad air pollution. Having radio waves that are not very good is just an extra hazard that we live nowadays.
Okay. Maybe we should get Brexit over with. What do you think, folks? Let's just go for it.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
So we're going to start this week with a clip from the Peter Fahey. He's a former chief constable of Manchester, and he's chairman of the National Police Council, Constables Council, NPCC. And here he is on 5 Live talking about, he's very concerned that some people are using the wrong language, and he wants people to stop using that language in concern of Brexit.
Everybody wants to have active political discourse, and clearly a time of very strong emotions. But for the police, it's the challenges when that crosses over into threatening behaviour, when it crosses over into harassment and abuse, when that is reported to them, and that then adds to the, you know, the workload that they've already got, as well as, you know, the preparations they're possibly having to make about moving officers around the country if there are problems. So, you know, it is about the officers, the police chiefs trying to send a measured way. We need to put people to think about the language, the consequences of their language, how others may misinterpret that, and, you know, and take that into more violent action. But on the other hand, not doing anything in a democracy to make it look like the, you know, the police force is in any way trying to discourage protests or to, you know, discourage active debate.
So good old 5 Live put on someone to, well, I suppose, counter that. And that chap was from an online political magazine, which has been going for a long time now. Very good, I have to say. Their editor is Brendan O'Neill.
I absolutely don't think the police should be the ones who draw any kind of line when it comes to political speech and political rhetoric. I actually think it's incredibly worrying, not the rhetoric around Brexit, but the fact that the police feel that they have the right to interfere in politics in this manner. I'm really shocked by what the National Police Chiefs Council have done. We don't live in a police state. We live in a free country. We live in a democracy, I hope. And yet here we have one of the top police officers effectively instructing campaigners and journalists on how they may speak about an incredibly important political issue. I think that really suggests we're moving in a worryingly authoritarian direction. And I would like to remind the police that it is not their business to police how people think or how people speak, and they really need to butt out of this whole discussion. If we're just talking about the expression of political opinion, I think they have to tread incredibly carefully, because we don't want to be in a situation where the police feel they can tell us what we should be thinking. The other thing I find astonishing about this, I mean, you know, let's not beat around the bush. A lot of this commentary about language and about heated rhetoric is being aimed at the Brexit side in this discussion. It is being aimed at those people out there, and there are millions of people out there who do feel that they have been betrayed. Betrayed is a perfectly normal word. Who might even feel that their MPs have behaved like traitors because they said that they would not block Brexit, and now some of them are trying to block Brexit. Yeah. People have to be free. I just think a lot of people will see this as a very arrogant intervention because on the one side, the establishment is taking action to prevent a vote from going through and then almost criminalising us if we get angry for protesting.
So that's Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online Political Discussion. Ron, where do you stand on this? I mean, he's being a little bit provocative there. He's just using all these words like traitor, betrayal, all these kind of words, just to explain what he means. And do you think that that actually might be some sort of incitement or not?
Well, I think that is indicative of the political discourse of this country. There is a tendency to over-dramatize, overstate positions. You demonize the opposition. You don't want to give any credit to those who have different views than yourself. And it's emblematic of an intolerance. And unfortunately, Brexit is brought out the worst within the British political system. I feel that it's not a question of betrayal. It's a question of an issue that is a very complex issue.
And it's not a word you'd use.
No.
But do you think it's okay for other people to use it? I mean, we're in a situation where there was a referendum 2 years ago, 3 years ago nearly now, and people voted to leave the EU. We were told, and the whole thing was legally set up to leave last weekend. And, of course, we haven't left. And basically, surely it's the politician's job to actually carry out what people voted for in the referendum. And if they don't, then, I mean, what are people supposed to do or say?
Well, the question is, no one actually defined Brexit. You know, people who say Brexit means Brexit are being somewhat simplistic. And here, this is one of the few times I would agree with Juncker, the president of the European Commission, when he said there has to be a special place in hell for those people who put forward Brexit without a plan. And I think the reason why Parliament cannot come to a consensus is because you have at least 50 different interpretations of what Brexit means. I can understand why people who voted for Brexit feel very frustrated, very angry, and even, quote, betrayed. But I think to blame it simply on those who turned their back or reneged on their promise, I think is somewhat wrongheaded.
Clive?
I think the context that the police were talking about, and actually Brendan's reply, was more about safety of politicians. And, you know, the MPs have been under a lot of pressure. In fact, you know, Joe Cox, of course, was killed before the referendum. And they're very worried, and the MPs are very worried about their safety. And that's where harassment and abuse is really crossing the line from the police point of view. So I think that's why the police have a valid situation from a valid comment for public safety of the MPs and to protect democracy. So I'm not sure that's an issue of free speech.
Surely the fact is here that the MPs are not protecting democracy by not implementing Brexit of any sort. At the moment, nothing's happened.
Each MP is doing what they think is right. It's just that there's probably 650 versions, and some of them think that the most important thing is to keep the Tory party together, which they've managed to do for 300 years. And others are thinking, well, we want to do the least worst harm, you know, customs union, Ken Clark, that sort of view. And then you've got some people in Labour that want to see the Tory party split. And some people would think, well, that's a good deal.
I was looking at this whole customs union thing because it's like a term that we hadn't heard much of, had we, before whatever, the campaign for the referendum. And if you have a look at it's really what it is the common market, really. Actually, it was the 1980s, the single market. That's what implemented the customs union. And it meant that effectively goods could travel across borders with no tariffs, no controls, no checks, that sort of thing. So effectively, it's one country. When they say a single market, it's one country. country for goods and services. That means, of course, one standard. And so that's a big part of what the EU does. And it was a big part of what we entered when we entered the common market. So I just wish some of the people talking about the customs union could say that's the single market, folks. You know, do you remember the single market? So that is outside the EU, but it's inside what would be the common market. Am I right, do you think, on that?
Yeah, that's the way and I'm looking at Ron because he's possibly more expert than a mild Bristol councillor. But the single market, the customs union is no tariffs and also trying to harmonise standards so that radio equipment in the UK works at the same frequencies and at the same power as in France and in Germany. So you've got those two things. And that's why you have to pay money in to this, keep this market working, to stop monopolies building, to make sure that people are moving towards similar standards. That doesn't come free, especially if there's no tariffs.
One thing I would add here is that the single market was something which was started not by European citizens. It was started by companies in Europe, and one of the leads on it was Visa Deco, who was the chairman of Philips Electronics. Mm. I did a little bit of work on this back in the 1990s and discovered a paper by an American PhD student who basically it was entitled, well, the piece I wrote was entitled Imagine Yourselves to Be Dictators of Europe, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page. What she said was that they had been trying to draw up this single market on a floor of the Philips building in Eindhoven, and this is how these things work. It's almost done within some of the big companies, and after a few weeks the people who'd been set on this task, who were seconded into Philips to do it, came back to the boss and they said, we can't do it because no one will ever accept this, and so we can't have a single market. And he said those immortal words, imagine yourselves to be dictators of Europe. Mm. In other words, what you're doing is running roughshod over the national governments. We need a policy which will not be looking at national interests, but will be looking at a EU-wide interests. So I found that quite a fascinating. It was Maria L. Green, American University visiting fellow at Harvard University, who wrote it, and her paper was called The Politics of Big Business in the Single Market Program, Maria L. Green. So, Ron, it does look as if these kind of big programs that we're in, the customs union, the single market, wherever they are, haven't really been drawn up by citizens. They've been drawn up by big business.
Yes, obviously, I think you're quite right to point out the power of corporations to lobby European governments, basically to set up a infrastructure which will allow them to conduct their business much more easily. But I want to step back, because one could argue the seeds of European economic integration, which actually then became the common market and eventually the single market, actually can be traced back to the Marshall Plan. Because the United States, as part of a reconstruction plan for Europe, and they were, you know, particularly Western Europe, they were very concerned about the perceived threat of communist or Soviet expansionism in Europe, use an economic recovery program, which basically allowed U.S. capital to build the infrastructure of Western Europe, made U.S. goods basically more accessible to the European market. And I think many of the American political economists were thinking about how an economic European economic integration would basically help re-establish capitalism, particularly in the wake of the Great Depression in the 1930s.
Clive, what do you make of that?
Well, you're better than me on history, but what I do know is that after the Second World War, one of the goals of the common market was to make it impossible for France and Germany to fight one another. And if you have a single market, Germany will then concentrate on what it's very good at, which is ended up making cars as one of them, and France will be very good at what it's good at, which I think was coal mining for a while. And consequently, if You can't go to war if one of you can't dig the coal and the other one's got all the steelworks. So that's how it first started with that goal. And then if different countries concentrate on different things, they become more efficient at it, which reduces costs to the consumer.
The trouble is, of course, over the years, that as there's been this single market, that cash has been able to flow wherever it wants, almost all of British industry has been bought up, closed down. I mean, even when we're talking about, oh, we want to save the Honda plant, for example, well, sorry, mate, but it's not even owned in Britain anymore. And the profits are all made outside the UK. And so it's very difficult to imagine anybody, sort of trying to continue investment in Britain in the long term.
But you can't blame the EU for that. That's been British governments over the years.
Actually, it was Thatcher, wasn't it, that stopped exchange controls. She just said that people invest and money can go back.
It might have been Thatcher or Major, but the ability for companies to just come in and buy our own countries. A lot of other EU countries won't allow you to buy Volkswagen or BMW or the like, whereas we have a free market for businesses. And similarly, we had much lower controls on redundancy packages and things like that, so it's much cheaper to sack people. So it was an incentive to people to move to the UK for low-cost labour and to take the risk, because if you shut down, it didn't cost you so much. I remember once, if businesses moved to France, because I studied business in France a long time ago, it was a huge risk, because once you'd set up and employed people, it cost you a fortune to get rid of them. I mean, years redundancy packages, that type of thing.
Good. That's the way it should be. Anyway, let's have a listen now to some of the action in the European Parliament this week. Not sure if it's all this week, but I mean, we're hearing very, very little of that. And Clive, before we came on, you commented that we never do hear the action from the European Parliament on the UK TV news. And so you're going to hear a little bit here tonight. And here is the representative of the negotiators to the European Parliament, Guy Verhofstadt, talking about how the resistance of people transferring power to Brussels should really be met by more of an effort to transfer powers out of the individual countries into Brussels.
And that is the real problem, colleagues. Why there is such a problem in this crisis? Because member states are reluctant to transfer new sovereignty and powers to the European Union. And we all know that the only way out of this crisis is a new transfer of powers to the European Union and to the European institutions.
Guy Verhofstadt is also very worried about the idea of Boris Johnson or Michael Gove taking over and him having to deal with them if we stay in the EU.
Can you imagine a little bit that the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, Mr. Johnson or Mr. Gove, both the architects of the Brexit disaster, would have the keys in their hands on the future of the European Union? I cannot think about it, that will happen.
Also, hitting back, I suppose, is the Nigel Farage from, well, he wasn't, not UK Independence Party, he's got his own little party now, because the UK Independence Party has gone off to the far right and become Islamophobic, so most sensible people have ditched it.
Pretty much hoping after nearly 20 years that this is my penultimate speech in this Parliament, and that I won't be coming back here again in July. And I'm sure many of you here would share that sentiment. Mr. Barnier, I told you that treaty wouldn't go through the House of Commons. You didn't believe me. It's been rejected. I think you pushed your luck too far. You asked for too much, and this morning you find yourself short of £39 billion. So I'm sure you're feeling a bit sore about that. But don't worry, help is at hand, because the House of Commons today will do, I'm sure, their utmost to betray the Brexit vote. They're even going to vote against what Article 50 said, which is, of course, that we leave on the 29th of March with or without a deal. And I have to say, I think the gap now between our political class in the UK and public opinion is a gaping chasm, because be in no doubt, public opinion is hardening. There is a greater sense of unity in the country than I've seen for some years. We simply want to leave, and that applies to many who voted Remain as well, because they respect the very principle of democracy. And we've had enough. We've seen the snarling anger towards our country of Mr. Verhofstadt, the bureaucratic intransigence of Mr. Barnier, the constant stream of insults that come from Mr. Tusk, and we're of one mind. We don't want to be governed by you. We want to govern ourselves. Now, I'm sure the next instalment of this will be the British Prime Minister next Thursday going to the European Summit in Brussels, another humiliating display where she begs for an extension to Article 50. Well, I've got a solution to all of this. What I heard you, Mr. Barnier, this morning say that if this treaty, if this withdrawal agreement gets passed, the next phase of negotiations could last for up to 4 years. I thought, enough. We don't want to waste 4 more years of our life, 4 more years of agony. And you don't want to waste another 4 years. You've got your plan. You want a United States of Europe. You want your army. You want everyone to join the euro. You want to get rid of the nation states. We are just a damned nuisance. And add to that, as Mr. Verhofstadt said, the European elections. You don't want me coming back here or hordes of Eurosceptics coming back here. So there is a simple solution, and that is that the British request to extend is vetoed at that European summit. We leave on March the 29th. Most of the preparations have been done. Even if there are a few short-term bumps in the road, we leave and both you and we can get on with the rest of our lives. That is the only neat solution ahead of us.
Well, you got a few claps anyway. Ron, I mean, what he's saying there, I suppose, is reflecting this nightmare scenario for the EU, which is that they might end up with Michael Gove, Boris Johnson or somebody sitting there on the European Council just vetoing everything for fun.
Well, I think, once again,
if there's an extension, that is, yeah.
Well, both statements, I think, illustrate what I said before about the polarization within this so-called debate about Brexit. The polarization basically establishes two extreme positions and doesn't recognize the complexity of the situation. For example, my understanding, according to the Financial Times, there were 756 agreements which would have to be renegotiated as part of the divorce settlement between the UK and the European Union. They not only cover trade agreements, but standards, various things dealing with traffic and transport, banking regulations, and so forth. So I think, yes, you could reach an understanding about a divorce, but the actual terms of that divorce might take much longer time. And, you know, it's not simply a question of who's going to be in power in this country. Whoever's going to be in power is going to have to face those realities, whether it be Jeremy Corbyn or Michael Gove or anyone else.
What about you, Clive? What's your prediction? Doesn't seem as if we're actually going to leave, although we're supposed to legally next Friday.
I'm not going to be stupid enough to make a prediction, I'm afraid. Take us back to the core things that people complained about the EU. One is the European Court of Justice out of control and bossing us around, and the other EU institutions. That was all about sovereignty. And we'd given too much of our power to this bigger institution.
But surely the reason most people, I mean, what the surveys say, was just basically to do with control of the borders and immigration, migration.
Well, that was the free movement of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the third one was the paying, was it $350 million a week? So the free movement of people one, if you forget the sovereignty issue and you're still happy to pay a bit of money for the harmonisation of the markets and making sure they're well managed and competition policy, the free movement of people, if you're going to cut that out, that gives all sorts of options which are much softer than the current Theresa May one.
Anyway, a former Labour MP in the city, I promised to do this a couple of weeks ago. I dug out a speech by Tony Benn about the EU, who was really vehemently against it. In fact, he carried on through in the Labour Party even after the switch. The Labour Party used to be Eurosceptic until under Neil Kinnock it swapped and became pro-EU. So this is what Tony Benn had to say a few years ago. It's a couple of little clips of his views on it. Bless him.
Are the British people, when they vote in a general election, to be able to change the policies of the government that has previously been there? And it is already a fact that whatever government is in power, our agricultural policy is now controlled from Brussels, our trade policy is controlled from Brussels, our industrial policy is controlled from Brussels. It is a democratic and not a nationalistic argument.
Well, I campaigned for the referendum, if you know this. I was in a minority of one on the National Executive and the Shadow Cabinet in 71. They didn't want a referendum, but in the end we got a referendum after we'd gone in and we lost it. And then I was on the Council of Ministers. And that was the most shattering experience I've ever been in my life, because I was the representative of Britain, and for 6 months I was the president of the Council of Energy Ministers. I wasn't allowed to submit a document. Only the Commission, who are bureaucrats, could submit a document. I could say yes or no, sort of a constitutional monarch, if you like. They controlled it. It met in secret. It made laws for Britain and everywhere else. It met in secret. And when I suggested we met in public, oh, they nearly strangled me, because all their dirty little deals would have come out. So the more I thought about this, and this is what it's about now, it is about democracy. Remember this. I was a member for 51 years. Members of Parliament are lent the powers of their constituents, and they have to return those powers undiminished at the end. It's not for members of Parliament to give away the powers that were lent to them, because they don't belong to members of Parliament, they belong to the electorate. And that is a critical matter. And now I say something else. I mean, we're primarily concerned with Britain, but it terrifies me that Germany didn't allow its own people to have a referendum on whether Germany should enter the European Union and have the treaty. And you know, before the war, Hitler wasn't exactly a democrat, and that practice of it everything being decided at the top has been carried on to that. France had a referendum, defeated it, and now Sarkozy's trying to bypass it. And we live in a continent where increasingly power has gone to a group of people who are not elected, cannot be removed, and don't have to listen to us.
Well, that's the former Bristol South MP, Tony Benn there. Clive, views very different to yours, I think.
Yeah, but I take some, you know, he's a very wise chap. He was talking about the situation before they'd strengthened the EU Parliament. It's still not strong enough.
He was an insider, wasn't he? He'd actually been sitting in the committee. I mean, this is one thing that bothers me about the EU. It's very, very distant. I mean, that's why, one of the reasons I played the clips from the European Parliament. It just happens. It just sort of happens to us without it, very much people knowing how it happens or where, why or when.
This is that sovereignty argument that you stopped me talking about earlier on with the Court of Justice and the
other institutions. Sorry, please, talk about it.
Yeah, well, now I will. So, a long, long, long time ago, and Ron's a historian, there was sovereignty in towns and cities, you know, when transport was by horse and cart and you had to walk to the market. And they had you had a lot of sovereignty, the burghers of a town or the councillors even.
Well, hang on, because they had independence, but they had royal charters which could be revoked if they misbehaved.
But they were, you know, they were given that. But even before we had a nation, that was put together by the Normans. So if you look over the long term, but now possibly, and I'm saying possibly, but one way of looking at it is that nations are not big enough to run certain aspects of their life. So the regulation of really big business, of Google and Facebook, has to be across nations, transnational. And that's where the people need to decide, yes or no, and I'm not to a certain extent putting either way, they need to decide whether an institution like the EU or even a global business organisation for regulation can manage these, because that's just the way technology and travel has gone.
Yeah, but the thing is, for example, China have said, well, you're not coming into China, Google, unless you play by our rules and pay your money. So we potentially could have done that as well.
EU could have done that. I don't think UK could.
Ron, what do you make of these arguments?
Well, I think Tony Benn has expressed what has become known as the Lexit position, in terms of a left position, why the UK would be better off outside the EU. I think it's based on a misconception of what sovereignty is about. We have sovereignty in this country. Look at the labor legislation. Look at the legislation dealing with taxation. even in terms of immigration, you know, we don't entitle all immigrants coming into this country to have access to benefits in the national health system service. And it also misconstrues what is the real threat to sovereignty, and that is the role of transnational corporations, which basically undermine any notion of a nation state being a sovereign entity to make decisions on its own behalf. So I think it's an illusion to talk about national sovereignty in this world of global capitalism. I just want to make
one. I think the Chinese might disagree with you.
I want to make one observation.
Or the Iranians.
And be as succinct as possible. My position on Brexit has always been very succinct. I'd rather deal with the devil I know than the devil I don't. I always thought Brexit was very risky. The analogy I would use is walking towards a cliff on a foggy day. You don't see the cliff edge. You have no idea if you're going to drop down 50 feet, 100 feet, 1,000 feet, 10,000 feet. And that is where we are now. We don't have a clear picture what Brexit will actually mean to
people. Let's ask about that very point, about the effect on the country economically. I mean, there's all sorts of other effects, but that's one of the main ones that's being argued about. And hear what the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King had to say about that.
One of the sad things about this whole debate is that the country has been deeply divided. People are passionate about it on both sides. They're not passionate because they have views about the economic effects. I've never met anyone who said, I'd be in favour of Brexit if I thought the impact on GDP would be less than 2%, but I'd be in favour of Remain if I thought it was more than 5%. It's the issues of identity and culture and politics that are motivating people, which is why I think that MPs have rather somehow lost the plot, because when we hear people talk about, you know, the consequences of leaving without a deal as national suicide, I wonder sometimes if the political class hasn't suffered a collective nervous breakdown and lost confidence in the country.
Well, let's just leave Brexit there with the thoughts of Mervyn King. Other things to talk about, certain types of vehicles could be charged to drive into Bristol under the council's new clean air plans, Clive. I suppose this is something you've been lobbying for.
Yes, I think the plans are going to not include people's vehicles. They will include taxis and buses.
That seems a bit unfair on taxi drivers. That's public transport.
Yeah. Indeed it is, but they're going to get grants and help with upgrading their engines so that they can reduce the emissions and therefore pass the test.
I feel really sorry for the taxi drivers. First of all, they were made to pay massive amounts of money to go and collect people from Temple Meads by good old First Group. And, you know, they do seem to be being bullied around, told, oh, you've got to have a blue taxi no matter how much it costs. I mean, we need these people. It's a bit like they're a competition for First Bus, and, you know, that someone doesn't like them.
No, I agree. It's an important service.
Absolutely crucial.
By the way, there's 500 blue taxis left and 2,000 Uber.
That's right.
So they really are
swarming
under threat.
They're swarming everywhere, aren't
and
they?
And Uber don't even have to pay the same fees because... So it's only places like Temple Meads where the blue taxis actually have a competitive advantage.
I don't know why the City Council have allowed Uber in. If you look at their record of raping customers, for example, it's absolutely horrific. They don't have a very proper system for professional drivers.
But if you have a licence from Stroud or somewhere like that, then you can still operate an Uber taxi in Bristol.
But maybe more importantly, maybe something that's going to affect us more is the Central London ULEZ is just coming in on Monday. Did you know what that stands for, Clive?
Ultra low emission zone.
Yeah, that's right. This is going to be in addition, if you're going to Central London, to the £11.50 daily charge, which is from 7 till 6 every weekday. This will be every day. So if it's a Saturday or a Sunday or in the middle of the night, you're still going to have to pay the ULEZ daily charge from the 8th of April, Monday. It's going to expand to the North and South Circular Roads on October 2021. Petrol cars from about 2006 on won't have to pay, and diesel cars from 2015 on won't have to pay. So if you've got an older car, it's better if it's a petrol car. You're less likely to pay it. Motorbikes from 2007 onwards will have to pay it. That's that £11.50. £12.50 it is for most vehicles, including cars, motorcycles and vans, up to including 1.3 tonnes. The argument, though, here is that this is anyone with a rich SUV Clive, is not going to have to pay this at all. The rich and powerful Londoners who you see driving around in their Chelsea tractors, this won't affect them one bit.
Exactly, because they're newer than 2015. Yeah. If you live within the zone, you don't pay the full charge, do you, I think? And it's also combined with scrappage schemes and upgrade. I've seen the Bath one where they're offering up to £2,000 to upgrade to a newer car.
Look, I just find it incredible that you've got a Labour mayor that's imposing tax on poorer people. These rich people
don't need
to. Well,
it's not, is he? That's why it's not. You're talking about the London one, and now we've switched back to Bristol. And Bristol,
well,
the Labour mayor is...
We're now talking about London, yeah? That's the London fee we're talking about.
Oh, the London. There. Yeah, gotcha.
Because I mean, you know, for any of us that drive into London, as I do probably once every few months, I don't usually drive into central London, so this won't affect me for a while. But it just seems to me an incredible way to go. It's just.
And how many people are dying in London through air pollution, through vehicles?
Yeah, well, how about we get the guys with these big SUVs to pay for it? The rich and, you know, people who can afford to pay. This is just another regressive tax. Anyway, Ron, what's your comments on that sort of system?
I don't have much to add. I think you pointed out the weaknesses of this plan. But I think at the end of the day, we need to tackle the threat posed by carbon emissions to our public health and to our environment. And
can't we just close streets like so many other cities do, or provide decent buses, for example, and cheap and easy to use taxis? That sort of thing. We're also
yes, I totally agree with that. But where do you start with that? You know, and that require basically a much more state interventionist approach, basically. And you already hear people crying out, "Oh, that's interfering with my right, basically, to travel the way I want to." And I think at the end of the day, when we talk about climate
people
change,
there's a whole campaign going on right now about Bristol's buses,
yes,
saying that they're overpriced, they're unreliable, and they're basically profiteering off of people's need to go to work every day.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. But I'm just pointing out it's probably a more fundamental issue about how you deal with climate change and the possible implications for the survival of the planet. There will have to be some sacrifices made, and people will have to change their patterns of living and consumption. And I think it's going to be a very rude awakening for people, and I think most people are not prepared for that.
Well, right on cue, we have Luke Watson from Extinction Rebellion now, and they are organising protests in London. I spoke to Luke earlier this week.
London, because it's the capital and it's where the elites live, and they're more concerned by what affects them. And it'll be, Monday the 15th at 11 a.m. in Parliament Square. And first is to meet there, and then to shut down central London by blocking the roads.
What about ambulances, things like that? Are they going to be allowed to go through?
The emergency services do have contingency plans for these type of things, and they've been warned in advance.
You chat to the police beforehand, you say we're going to do this and that. I mean, there must be a temptation to not give your plans away to them.
No, we're completely open, because so many left-wing movements have been infiltrated by the police and things like that. One way of getting around that is to just be completely upfront.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in joining you in London, what should they do?
They should go on the Extinction Rebellion website. There's a briefing of what to expect. It's a bit vague because we
so
have
that,
to see
that gives you a bit of an idea. But I mean, there are local groups meeting, aren't there? So probably one of the things to do is actually go and meet people and talk to them.
Yes,
here in Bristol, you've got two groups. You said one at Malcolm X Centre and one in Southfield. So what's the best way to find out where they are and go along and meet some XR people?
There's a Bristol specific Extinction Rebellion website. xrbristol.org.uk.
Where and when do the groups meet in? Because that might be handy for people if maybe they haven't got the internet.
Yeah.
Or like me, the internet isn't working at home from time to time, or get cut off, or whatever.
The one in South Bristol is on Tuesdays at the Quaker Meeting House, 52 Wedmore Vale. And the other one is at the Malcolm X Community Centre on City Road on Wednesdays.
At what time?
They are both 6 to 7 is a meal, and then from 7 to 9 is the meeting. So if you have time, it's quite nice to go to the meal and have a chat with people. The food's pretty good normally.
So that's Luke Watson from XR. Either it's Extinction Rebellion, it's XR. So there's some details there. I'll put links up on our show page to that. Will you be going to protests, Clive?
No. I respect very much the way demonstrating their democratic right, and that's fine. I might well have done that 30 years
Ron,
ago.
Ron, what about you?
I'm ambivalent about that. I'm very sympathetic to direct action. I've taken part in a number of protests which would...
How else to get the government to take notice?
Well, my concern about Extinction Rebellion...
You've got 2 seconds to answer.
...approach is I'm not quite sure what the end game is.
Time now for the US-owned Comcast News at 7. Thanks to our guest Green Party councillor for Clifton Down, Clive Stevens. Join Ron and I after the US-owned Comcast News as we spread our wings, around the world.
Your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.